Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Chisholm, and this time my guest is Australian ocean racer, Sail GP, and America's Cup sailor, Luke Parkinson. Luke, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast, and thanks for taking the time to join us. We're both here in the bustling city of Barcelona. It is very bustling right now. It's the host city for next year's America's Cup, and you're part of the British Ineos Britannia Syndicate. I want to talk about the America's Cup a bit later on, but for now, how have you been enjoying the atmosphere here in Barcelona?
Thanks, Justin. Barcelona's been great. It's really busy. It's quite a contrast living in such a busy city. Summer's been pretty hot, and now we're moving into the new season, and it's quite nice to see the city changing a little bit.
Now, you guys trained in Palma, Mallorca over the winter. That must have been a nice experience.
Yeah, Palma was fantastic. It's such a good sailing venue. The people were really great. Our timing was pretty nice as Palma was ramping up in the heat, and you know, the tourists were rolling in. We sort of moved out and transitioned to Barcelona here. So it's been quite a positive few months for us.
Fantastic. Now, we'll get into a bit of America's Cup stuff later on, but regular listeners to the podcast will know I like to take my guests back to their roots in sailing, where it all began. So let's do that with you. Let's go back to the early part of your sailing career and start by telling us, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Yes, I was born in Perth, Western Australia, and grew up most of the time around Fremantle, and started sailing at Fremantle Sailing Club when I think I was about 5 years old.
And what drew you into sailing? Why sailing for your family? Is that the Parkinsons? Are they a sailing family, your parents?
I think the large part of our family being in sailing was driven pretty hard by my dad. And I think he got the bug through my grandpa, who bought a ketch and sailed around Australia with my mum and dad. And I think that's sort of the roots of it for the Parkinson family.
So for you, what was the first time you went sailing that you can remember? Who were you with? What boat was it? Where was it? Give us the details.
I think the earliest memories I've got is sailing mirror dinghies back at Fremantle Sailing Club, sort of doing local or the learn to sail sort of course, just inside the rock wall there with my cousins Tom and Dan.
Can you remember that first time? Can you remember what it felt like? And I always like to ask people the sailing bug, when did it bite them? Was it back then when you were five, or do you not really remember?
Back when I was quite young, I wanted to sail out, further past the rock wall. I wanted to get out and get racing. To do so, I had to pass the TL1, the Learn to Sail course, which I actually I cheated, to be honest. I couldn't climb into the boat, which was one of the tests you needed. And while the instructor wasn't looking, an older guy gave me a lift up into the boat. It sort of progressed from there. I very much liked riding motorbikes and everything with a motor that went quite fast. And I think it was to my dad pushing me and making me stick with it is why I'm still in sailing today.
Were there any other sports that you're a very competitive individual, I know that. Were there any other sports that you played at that point?
Yes. So growing up, I was pretty heavily into swimming, staring at that black line for quite a few years until I could convince my parents that I didn't have to do that anymore. And also playing rugby quite a lot through especially high school. Yeah.
What was your stroke in swimming?
Breaststroke, actually.
Right.
Trying to make use of those skills now a little bit with a bit of freestyle as well.
I was a swimmer too at school, but mine was backstroke. So I was looking at the ceiling, waiting for the line of flags that you knew the turn was coming up soon. So I feel your training was pretty miserable in that sport. So which dinghy classes did you progress through? Started in mirror dinghies and then what next?
Yeah, so the mirror dinghy was where it started, but they were a little bit slow. I dabbled very briefly with the oppie, but quickly realized I didn't really like sailing by myself very much. So then the next best thing was a flying ant, which is a two-person skiff for, you know, two people about 40 and 50 kilos, little trapeze, little skiff boat, went pretty fast, pretty appealing. And I thought lots of the cool kids were sailing those, so I had to get into one of those, which led in pretty nicely to the 29er and the timing of that coming online through Australia and the Youth Worlds program. So I managed to get into that. And from there it was into the, I quickly outgrew the 29er as I closed in on 17, 18 and transitioned to the 49er, where I switched around over a number of years being helm and crew and helm and crew again, which was, yeah, I was trying to do as much as I could on a shoestring budget, and yeah, some pretty fond memories of those times.
Now, where does your sister Tessa come into this equation? I can't remember whether Tessa is older or younger than you, but she had a successful Olympic career herself.
Yeah, Tess is a couple of years older than me, and she progressed through the 420 background and then into the 470, and yeah, she was definitely a couple of steps in front of me for quite a number of years, ticking a lot of boxes and very much the favourite child for a while there, bringing home a gold medal for Beijing at her first Olympics was incredible.
Yeah, that, I mean, I can imagine there'll be some sibling rivalry between you, but you must have been proud of your sister winning the gold.
Yeah, I was amazingly proud, and it was very special to go to China and to watch on the sidelines and to support where we could. And it all sort of happened very quickly, and was a little bit surreal how, yeah, their sort of path that led to going to China.
And Tessa was helming or crewing? I can't remember.
Yeah, Tess was in the bow. She was crewing for Elise Ricci. Yeah.
So you saw that. You saw all of that stuff. You saw your sister, basically a professional sailor, if you're winning gold medals at the Olympics. When was the point for you that you set your stall out that professional sailing was going to be what you wanted to do with your life?
It wasn't for a number of years after that. I was still... so I made a shift to move over east to Sydney, and I started working on yachts as a bit of a nipper. I was working on Loki, and basically was trying to get as many sea hours as I could and get experience and get a bit of a feel for it. Started sailing up and down the coast, did quite a few thousand miles with them actually, got quite comfortable offshore, and sort of realized that team was very good to me. They gave me a lot of opportunities. They got me to sail in almost every position on the boat. But I sort of realized I was in a little bit of a rut, and I really missed the Olympic sort of sailing, controlling my own sailing to an extent, and felt like I had a bit of unfinished business, almost stepped back into the Olympic sailing for a little while after that. And I really wanted to give it a go to see how far I could get on, you know, get onto the funding. And I guess that was when the transition towards professional sailing sort of continued.
What made you abandon those Olympic hopes? Was it just you just couldn't make the breakthrough and qualify?
We got quite high up. We were sort of next to, well, we started training partners with Nathan and Goobs. But I always had this sort of itch to go ocean racing, and I was starting to get some good offers to go racing with some pretty good private owners, and I was sort of using that to fund my Olympic sailing and for them to get the flights to go back and forth between events. And I was sailing on what used to be the Ragamuffin with Sid Fisher, which is with Dave Witt, who I'm still very good friends with, and we were doing the Hong Kong Vietnam race, and we had Ian Walker come and join us, who famous ocean racer, of course, fantastic gentleman. And that was sort of what started leading the door to open to further opportunities with racing around the world with Walks.
Those boats you've mentioned, Loki and Ragamuffin, there's a real scene down in Australia with these big 100-foot maxis, and I always associate it with the Sydney Hobart, but there's a big scene down there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's really, we're very lucky in Sydney. It's one of the few places in the world where there's a good sailing professional scene where you can, you know, you can earn money to go race yachts during the week and on the weekends. There's a whole different range from, I guess, from J70 sort of sailing through the TP class and into the big super maxis.
You mentioned David Witt, who, when you met Ian Walker and he picked you for the Abu Dhabi Ocean Racing team, that's when we first met. I was working, doing communications with that team. And I remember Ian saying that, you know, I was like, so who is this Australian guy? And he said, well, he's one of Witty's recommendations. And I think he's done that not just for you, but for several people, hasn't he? He's kind of been like a little incubator for some of the really talented sailors who've come through in recent years.
Yeah, Witty, the kid, grew up through 18s, and he's been a fantastic guy for giving people like myself opportunities and mentoring us and getting us on to the like deliveries, coaching us on how to steer and how to manage different situations. And I guess the without sailing with Witty and doing those miles on the big boats and getting to drive and opportunities like that, it's pretty hard to get the hours up and to be able to prove yourself once you do get onto the Volvo boats or something similar. And yeah, like Annemieke Best is another prime example. She was sailing with the Ragamuffin and the Scallywag for a number of years before her opportunity started with AXA Noble, and then she jumped across to join us and in this last ocean race as well. So yeah, Witty's definitely a great person who's been giving plenty of young opportunities. Yeah.
So I remember you joining the team, and I think you were, what age were you back then? It's 2000 and what is this, 14, 15?
Yeah, about 23, I think.
Yeah, maybe. I think you were a little bit younger because I seem to remember you having a significant birthday, but maybe I'm mixing that up. But I remember Ian said to me that the, you know, he'd been down and done the race with you guys in the Hong Kong to Vietnam race, which is a classic race, of course. And you know, he deliberately was looking at you for selection for the ocean race team. And he said, so I made sure I shared a room with him before we did the race because he wanted to see your work ethic. And I remember just being really struck by that because it's not. Professional sailing isn't all about just your sailing ability, although that's super important. It's about the whole package, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was that was quite a funny memory, actually. I'd never met Ian Walker. Obviously, he was a big mentor. Well, not mentor, but I was looking up to him, so much. And, you know, it was itching to get on his team, itching to get a trial. And then suddenly the crew list rolls out and the, you know, you check into your hotel and it's like, oh, you'll be sharing with Mr. Walker. And I'm like, oh, okay. No idea what time he arrives. So then, you know, trying to sleep in a little single bed. And yeah, it was quite nerve wracking that, but we ended up getting along really well. And yeah, one thing sort of led to the other.
Yeah. And, you know, good work ethic, good sailor. And also physically, you know, one of the things you're perhaps famous for is your physical prowess. And has that always been the case from being a youngster upwards, or how did that all work out?
Well, I've sort of been, I think back from my swimming days, I had quite good cardio, and yeah, just always been into sport quite a lot. And I was always trying to lose weight to helm the 49er, which was a bit of a battle. But once I started closing the door on the 49er sailing, I began to work quite hard on the physical side, and I did put in a lot of effort with that. Once Ian confirmed I had a trial with Abu Dhabi, I did everything I could to put on weight, and I got up to about 94 kilos, which is about 11 or 12 kilos more than I am now. And I ended up turned up in Santander to see some friends and to help my sister out for an ISAF Worlds, and a few people were pretty blown away with what I'd done to get to the size that I was.
Yeah, there was no fat on you, I remember. That was all muscle, right?
Yeah, and I was just trying to be as durable as I could, and I'd taken the advice, and a lot of friends had pointed me in the right direction and got around me and trained with me as well, which made a huge difference. But I guess to answer your question, yeah, I've been very lucky with my, natural ability to be fit and also to be able to change my body for across the years for cardio, for strength, and also to get down to size when I've really had to.
So this first Volvo Ocean race was a real, as far as I can see, a real kind of springboard for you into the world of professional sailing. What do you remember about that race? I mean, let's just say, first of all, you ended up winning that race at your first attempt, which is not that common, I don't think. It was a pretty interesting race. It was all in one designs. And I know Ian was very keen on the idea of one designs, but what do you remember from that race?
Yeah, it was quite a massive learning curve for me. It was kind of like going to school. I was on the bow, and Justin Slattery was basically my teacher, teaching me the old tricks. And I guess with that campaign, I was, very, very lucky that we had quite a long training period beforehand and a big lead up. So by the time we got to the start line, we'd done a few transatlantics and quite a few thousand miles. So we, felt very comfortable in the boat, and we felt ready. But along with that, I think the team that Ian put together was very special in terms of the skill set and the personalities that were all involved. And I didn't really appreciate that until probably the last 20% of the race, the last few legs, where it all kind of made sense and everyone sort of gelled. And, when someone was tired, there was always someone with this, like, an adequate skill set to fill in, and there wasn't any holes. So that was a big thing to be a part of. And I still remember that as one of the greatest teams I have been in.
There was very little crew rotation, as I remember it. Lots of other teams seem to be swapping people in and out. I think it did happen on occasion due to sickness, but you guys pretty much were a tight unit all the way around.
Yeah, Neil McDonald jumped on for the leg up to China and a few other little rotations, but it was a pretty solid squad. And it, really had that feel like if you were really tired on a watch, someone else could cover your stint on the wheel or trimming, and everyone sort of just, promoted each other to get the best out of each other.
Before you took that race on, was your role on the boat a bowman, or did you kind of end up as the bowman because that was where the vacancy was?
When I was sailing with Witty, I was pretty much, his bowman for the number of races leading up. But once we were sort of up and going, I was trimming and helming quite a lot for that squad as well. So I sort of felt pretty comfortable in any of the positions on the boat, and that sort of came from the background of sailing on Loki, sort of being the guy who filled the gaps for whoever the crew spot was needed each week. So I was quite lucky in that sense. And then I think once you start going into ocean racing with a small number of crew, 6 or 8 or 11, depending on the race, that just gets stronger and stronger and works for you, and everyone sort of needs to have that understanding of how the boat works and how to make them go fast.
I did some sailing with you guys on the Round Britain and Ireland race, and the one thing I remember as the stand-in OBR on that was just how hard you guys pushed. It was a windy, super windy race, and there was never a point where you guys were backing down. It was just relentless, hour after hour, day after day.
Yeah, that was a hell of a run, that sailing around a low pressure system. That was one for the record books and one that will be a life memory, I think. But yeah, that with that team, it was sort of everybody was extremely comfortable, very confident in each other. We'd practiced, even practiced maneuvers without saying any words. And yeah, it's sort of the more time that you spend with a team, the more you build confidence and your comfort level just goes higher and higher. We're pretty comfortable with all our equipment and our maintenance of the boat. And yeah, we could push really hard.
It was a special race because it was one design, and it always seemed to me like it would only take one slip up, one torn sail, one bad jibe, and the fleet would be on you again, despite how well you'd sail over maybe even a period of a week on these offshore legs. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, it was really intense. It was so close. And I guess that was the first race where everyone started getting used to seeing another boat for days and weeks at a time. I remember that it really vividly, like we're racing Dongfeng across the bottom to South Africa, and Walks was trying to manage the boat. He knew that we're fast and he was confident that other people were going to slowly make mistakes. He was confident in the team, and basically he would set a boat speed average that we would have to stay underneath, otherwise you'd get off the wood or you'd have to rotate trimmers. And we're all sort of, the 0.1 underneath his limit that he had set as the skipper for looking after the equipment. It's funny how even when we were trying to slow down, it was a competition to see how close we could get to the limit that Ian had put up for us.
Without breaking it. Yeah. And that race is just a massive adventure, isn't it? I mean, you're a young guy racing around the world, visiting places you hadn't been to before. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, well, growing up in Fremantle, I'd always gone down and seen the ocean racing boats coming into port broken, the Jules Verne boats coming in and broken. Dad showing me going through the class 40s and so forth. And it's just something I'd always dreamed of doing growing up, and I very much so watched the 70s racing around. And the respect for the trade routes and the history of the race is massive, and I still have a big place for that race. And
yeah, so another Volvo race, or not, it's not the Volvo anymore, it's the Ocean Race, but another one for you at some point in the future?
Yeah, I've got a big place with ocean racing, and I think I think that's where I'll go back to, I think.
Fantastic.
Well, at some point.
Yeah, and that leads me on to these Imoca, amazing foiling Imoca boats that we've seen racing this last edition of the race. What's your position on all that? There's a little bit of criticism from the diehard fans of that race that sailing around the world inside isn't really how it should be done. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a tricky evolution of the sport happening at the moment where the boats are getting really fast and there is less people on board, both inshore and offshore, really. How much of the people are outside, how much can you see them doing? They're pretty big question marks. How much computer interaction do we want to see, and it's a big part of how the sport's going to shape up. And yeah, for me, I think there's sort of a point where we need to see the sailors still sailing the boat. We need to limit the computers to an extent, so there's still some errors and people steering boats, and may not be all the time, but it should still be part of our sport, especially in the crewed section of our sport, like the ocean race. So I think there's a bit of a tricky balance, and it would be nice if we just transition to full foiling, like adding T-rudders as a small addition to a, there's a massive performance benefit there, I believe, for that class in particular. And yeah, just having a good number of crews, so there's still good roles and still trimming and not too much performance compromised on how everyone's getting around in the fastest manner.
But you'd keep it in the Amokas if you were running the ocean race. You'd keep it in Amokas rather than move back to say something like the VO65.
I'm not sure. I think the direction of foiling is the right direction. It doesn't have to be an Amoka. It doesn't have to be a 65. I think a boat with a good amount of one design components to reduce cost, share spares, like spare tubes, for example, and even keels and things like that could be good features. And it is up to the class and the organization how they want to manage that. But it's also important to realize that they are different to the single-handed Amoka class, and the boats are going to handle differently when you put, you know, people on there. And because there is people on there, we want to see, you know, the sailors sailing the boats. We don't want to see the computers doing all the work. And I think they need to keep the differences there. And if it means that the Amoka is not quite right, then I don't think they should be, you know, afraid to veer off in a slightly different path to keep the race. From that last edition, it was also pretty evident to me how there was a maximum. It was interesting watching from the sideline how, like, the maximum attention span, I guess, of the viewer, and I guess also from the racer point of view, once a leg gets over a certain distance, it's more about completion, and you have to preserve the boat and look after things quite a lot more. So the percentage that you're pushing reduces quite a lot. So the maximum leg length is definitely a factor for me as well. Somewhere between that 20 and 25 day mark, I think, is a good number.
Yeah, I think you'll be getting thumbs up from a whole bunch of ocean race fans. And it's important to realize, I think, and to recognize that all of these races only really happen because of the commercial ventures, the sponsorship, and that is all based on eyeballs on the race. If people stop watching, then the sponsors won't come and the race, you know, just won't happen. So I think you make valid points.
If the boats are the same, less people will be interested to watch them as well. So having a point of difference is always very important.
Yeah, that's another good point. Now, another event in the sailing firmament that often drives controversy is of course the America's Cup. I think you're on your third America's Cup campaign, am I right?
Yeah, that's right.
So let's just go back a little bit. You talked about ocean racing and seeing the ocean racing boats come in. Was the America's Cup also an early dream for you?
Well, the America's Cup wasn't really a dream for me until I saw them go foiling. I do remember very well the Oracle Trimaran and the Alinghi Catamaran, and for me that was a pretty big line in the sand to thinking the America's Cup was actually appealing. Before then it was, you know, it was a fantastic sport and a massive part of sailing, but it just wasn't a corner of the sport that I had much interest in at all, just because of the boats and the style. So that was, that was probably a pretty big moment in it for me.
We talked earlier on about the stepping stone or the springboard the ocean race gave you. I feel like once people knew who you were from the ocean race, they knew about your fitness, they knew about your ability, suddenly doors seemed to open up for you. There was offers from America's Cup teams. There was offers from SailGP, as an example. Is that how it happened, or was it more subtle than that?
Once I started with Abu Dhabi, we had Pete Cunningham, he was our fitness instructor trainer, and he was also working with Artemis, and he noticed my fitness capabilities in like the 4 minute row in particular. Back then was the test, and he got speaking to Perse, and they thought I was a good pick for a bit of an all rounder, potential grinder, but backup wing trimmer for Goobs. And as I was going around the world with Abu Dhabi, that door started opening up for the opportunity to follow.
So that, of course, was with Artemis and Percy's Ian Percy, Goobs is Ian Jensen. All of these people that you you know from your time in the Olympic classes. So it's, I feel like you already knew the people. It was just kind of the opportunity was presenting itself to you.
Yeah, it was far less daunting, I suppose, when you start having the conversations and you know some of the other people on the team. And it does make a big difference to integrating into a team when, you know, you walk in the door and there's one or two familiar faces that you can, you know, even someone to have lunch with and just to ask where things are and how the certain processes are makes the familiarization so much more comfortable. Yeah, but it's, I guess that was the way that sort of led into Artemis and the Bermuda Cup. And throughout that cup, I was sort of chopping and changing a little bit in role, both on the 45F and grinding and trying to find my way to how am I going to get on the race boat. And it ended up being that the going down the grinding path was the ultimate way to get onto the A team and trim the jib and basically get a lesson on how to trim a jib from Christian Camp. And he upskilled me very quickly, and that sort of made the difference.
You obviously found the foiling catamarans. That was very appealing to you. That was right in your sweet spot.
Yeah, those boats are amazing. They feel like you're going really fast. You're up out of the water. They're very appealing to the eye. And yeah, little tweaks, like we were still learning. Well, little tweaks now with Sail GP is what makes the difference. You know, our ride height is all within sort of 50 mil for the whole fleet. But back then we were trying to learn how to foil tack, how to get around the race course without running out of oil and sort of fighting the fever on. If you do stop grinding, you crash because you run out of rake pressure. So it's come a long way since that period of the sport.
So you came out of that Artemis campaign for the Cup in Bermuda, and what happened next? Was it an instant transfer over to the British?
Towards the end of Bermuda, the Volvo race was cranking up again, and I was sort of umming and ahhing whether to get involved, and then some good friends of mine started saying that they were going to race, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to miss out on that. I want to go and race as well. And I still had the bug, and there was a few opportunities there, and some of which didn't work out, but some, yeah, maybe for the better. I ended up sailing with my good friend Dave Witt again, and this time it was went from being the youngest and the rookie on board to being one of the most experienced on board and basically going straight in as a watch captain. So that was a full new experience for me. And while trying to teach the other guys, I was very much learning myself at a rapid rate. And it was, yeah, the opportunity that Witty gave me there to really test myself to become a leader and to very quickly grow up was pretty unreal.
So very, very different race for you personality-wise. You're talking about being a leader, whereas, when you mentioned Justin Slattery, you were being mentored then. Must have been quite a different race for you.
Yeah, very different. Trying to, manage when to give people their time off, and also having those conversations on those hard moments. It's like, oh, why can't I steer? And it's sort of like, oh, well, we've done all this training and we've, you know, that's not really your skill set. You've been to an Olympics as a trimmer. We need to optimize those skills right now. And, trying to have those conversations without putting people down and trying to get the best out of them, because how do we get the performance into the boat? Being the responsible guy, trying to get people to put their life jackets on. Yeah, it was pretty, very stressful, I would say. Not always enjoyable, but the team was in a pretty good space and we had some really good people. We sailed the first leg with the least amount of crew compared to the others because we didn't have the female additions yet. So that was not only were we doing it with less crew, but I was in a new role and not sleeping much, and it was a real test. But we had a really good team And some of those guys now are, you know, they're doing very well in the professional sailing scene around the world. And we're quite a good, you know, tight group of friends there.
And you ended up winning legs during that race, more than one leg, I think, two legs during the race?
Yeah, we had a an interesting race, to say the least. And the team was ramping up and we were getting some good results. We were definitely in the mix. And there was a few things that were always challenging to try and change in the team. And I was struggling with a few things and struggling with the amount of rest that I was getting. And my good friend Stephen Howells withdrew from being the navigator, and he was a large part of the team for me. He resigned once we got to Cape Town, and I was leaning pretty heavily on him for, well, of course, the navigation and strategic direction in my role, and sort of had a few, I guess, question marks to the direction that we were going with the replacement, I suppose. And at the same time, the super foiler came up, and I
just explain what the super foiler was. First of all, I was trying to remember what that class was called a few days ago, and I couldn't for the life of me think of it. But just describe it for those who don't know.
Yeah, the super foiler is it's the best boat I've ever sailed. It's very fast. It's a 3-person dinghy, very similar to an 18-foot skiff, but on steroids and foiling boat. We got it to about 37 knots, and we're trying to slow it down. They're very fast and quite loose. So they had there's only ever been one season of racing, and they were developing very quickly. And it was just an Australian circuit, but it was a very steep learning curve and a very fond memories of that circuit.
So did you stepped away from the race to take up that opportunity with the super foiler from the ocean race, I mean?
Yeah, I had some hard conversations with Witty and in Melbourne after we'd gone through the Southern Ocean for the first part of that race, and sort of agreed on the direction that I was going to take, and, you know, take on my own super foiler team, and continue through to Hong Kong. And he had a plan to continue on from that point. So that was sort of a bit of a fork in the road for the Scallywag Volvo team there.
Sounds like you did a lot of growing up in that period. Some hard decisions, some hard conversations with somebody that you really respect and you know, probably would not want to be upsetting, and also taking on your own team on a professional circuit, a fledgling professional circuit. Lots of growing up, I think.
Yeah, it was very difficult. As you know, a great mate of mine, and also a work colleague at that point, to have hard, honest chats with, it's not easy. And it was just difficult, and it took quite a while to sort of come back from that in some ways.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, let's get into the America's Cup stuff now. We've touched on your background with Artemis in the Bermuda Cup. The next cup for you was which one, and how did you end up, I think, with the British?
Yeah, so I ended up with Ben, and that came around through John O'Macbeth, actually. He approached me and offered me a trial, and at the time I was just finished sort of the Volvo, and they were doing quite a lot of GC sailing. It was a new class, and again, my good friend Ian Jensen Goobs, he'd transitioned to that class, and another West Australian, Graham Spence, had also gone there. Chris Brittle was also there from the previous team I was with, and very similar to what I said before, there was a lot of familiar faces around, and I think that makes quite a big difference when you're going into big teams like that, if you have the option. And yeah, I guess with the nationality rule, that's pretty hard on the America's Cup. I had pretty limited options, I suppose. It was either there or a small window with the Americans, but because of more people that I knew and I guess the UK was more attractive through my British passport and from where my grandpa came from.
So the British passport came from your grandfather. That was one of the questions I was going to ask. So you slotted into that British team and you're now on your second campaign with them.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me a little bit about how different an America's Cup program is to an Ocean Race program. The Ocean Race felt like a lot of people when we were sailing around the world, but there really is a lot of people in these America's Cup teams, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing is the time commitment. The campaign duration for the Cup is at least double to an Ocean Race campaign at the moment. So it's quite a large number of years, really. Like it's a solid time away from, in my case, from Australia and family and friends. So that's quite a big part of it. And then the next part is how big the team is. So the team is over 100, and I guess the roll on from that is the impact that you can have as an individual is a little bit smaller because of the number of people. So you can really bleed your heart and soul into it, and the instant feedback for sure can be a little bit more brutal compared to when you're putting everything into a team of 20 people. You definitely feel like you get more back, and also with the culture as well, when you're one of the senior people in the team, or even a smaller part of the team, when morale's low, if you know there's 20 people and you're one of those people, it's a lot easier to have a positive effect and to begin to turn things around. So they're quite big parts of the America's Cup dynamic.
Yeah, and I mean, immediately you say that, I'm thinking back to the last Cup when you guys struggled in the lead up to Christmas with the boat not really functioning properly. And, you know, I remember it was Fortress Ineos. You know, you guys kind of locked yourself away over Christmas and came back transformed. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, that was not great, but we sort of knew to an extent from the build up. We knew what we were in for. We knew what could come to the forefront of reality and to the eyes of the rest of the world. We're going to see what we sort of already knew and what we had already started fixing. So, that was actually, Ben sat us all down and said, you know, we had to stay as a pretty tight unit here. We know what could happen and we know what's going to be said about us. And, that was definitely a time to, you know, stay pretty closely connected as a group. We'd just gone through COVID and, the team bonded pretty well over that.
So now here we are. I just want to bring it back up to date. Here we are a year out from the Cup, almost exactly. All of the teams are here and training in Barcelona. The Italians are kind of in and out between their Cagliari base and here. The atmosphere is fantastic. When all the teams are out on the water, there's a real buzz to it. The team bases are flying the country flags from the cranes once the boat's been launched. Do you get a sense of that when you're out on the water? I mean, I know you're working pretty hard while you're training.
Yeah, it is great being here. And when you get out there and the other teams are going, the intensity sort of always rides up that little bit more. And especially when, you know, you might have a quick cross with another team as you're transitioning to a different sort of zone or area of training. And that feeling of, you know, when your competitor's out there training and you're not, hits home pretty quick when you're all in the same spot. So everyone's pushing pretty hard and searching for those little things that are going to make a difference to the boat that your team's going to build and give you to race in 10 months' time.
From the outside, sailing in the America's Cup, being an America's Cup sailor seems super glamorous, and it is. It's something people aspire to do. It's hard work as well, though, isn't it? Can you give, you know, for people listening to this who don't really maybe appreciate the workload for an America's Cup team, can you give them a sense of, you know, like a typical week for you?
Yeah, well, the cup comes in waves, and the yeah, there's moments where the team's running a night shift. There's a squad that's going to roll in, launch the boat, and then a whole almost another squad is going to go out, sail the boat, operations, you know, the ribs, the whole infrastructure, and then coming back in, there'll be almost another squad of guys who are going to come in and help take the boat out, do system checks or maybe some modifications or fix some things that got damaged. So there's sort of the days that are, you know, they can be monsters. And there's also days where, like the rest of sailing, where they're calm and, you know, we're in the shed, things are being modified, serviced, and then everything's all about the data and computers and video and sort of learning as quickly as we can. So there's pretty, I guess it's very easy to be a bit of a roller coaster, the cup in these earlier stages, especially with new concepts and test boats. They can all, you know, can be operating and going really well and then break and be offline for a number of days. And as these pulses and hits and highs and lows hit the team, it's an always an interesting dynamic to see the fatigue levels and emotions running up and down.
Big teams, 100 plus people. Can you possibly know everybody, know their names and know something about them?
You learn most of them. There's always a few. We've got a bit of a different dynamic with Mercedes being based in Brackley. So the guys who are here in Barcelona pretty much know all of them, and you see most of them day to day. And you have a bit of a, whether it's collaborating in different areas, you might know them or just see them in passing. But it's quite hard for us to know everyone in our team with a little bit of a disconnect across Mercedes as well.
And how different is it technology-wise having the Mercedes element to it? It seems like the whole cup has stepped forward from a technology point of view to me. We're hearing about artificial intelligence being deployed in various areas, although we don't really know whether it is or it isn't. It's a super technical cup, isn't it now?
Yeah, I guess the big power coming from things like Mercedes is the computer power and the modeling and their ability to run multiple things through the models quite quickly, and also the ability to adapt and to fix things when things aren't going right, like what we saw in New Zealand. I believe other teams might not have been able to fix and react like we were able to go from, you know, not foiling to a very competitive team. So that's where those, you know, the likes of Mercedes really flex their muscles and show their strengths.
This big team, the work ethic we talked about earlier is even more important, isn't it? As a sailor, you want to be seen to be contributing to the team beyond your sailing, not just, it would be easy to think of the sailors as prima donnas who sweep off to their Winnebagos after they've been sailing like movie stars. But what I've witnessed is very different to that. I often see the sailors helping launch the boat, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I guess there's quite a few different skill sets in our sailing team and I guess our roles. And I guess communicating to the designers is one of the hardest things that I guess a modern professional sailor will have to do, and trying to transfer sailing terminology and language into design knowledge to basically F1 knowledge, who, you know, a very knowledgeable designer or computer programmer who doesn't actually go sailing. How do you transfer the knowledge or what you need in control to one of those people? So those sorts of communication barriers are quite hard, and there's definitely some sailors and some designers who are a lot better at those things.
Where do you see yourself in that? Is that one of your skill sets now?
I dabble. I get quite involved in the controls group, and mainly with the foil sort of interaction and forces. But it's very depending on the relationship that you have with a particular designer and how that goes.
nice segue into the fact that you've now transitioned into this flight controller role in both SailGP and with the America's Cup team. Did you set your stall out to do that, or is it how did it all come about?
The flight controller thing sort of came around in, I guess, in the Bermuda Cup. In the manoeuvres, I was controlling quite a bit of the foil inputs. And then as SailGP looked towards having a pilot, Nathan Outridge picked me to join the Japan team as their pilot for that new role, which I was really interested in, the controlling the foils. That's the part of, I guess, of foiling that really fascinates me. And the designer who did a lot of the programming and integration, Jonathan Nichols, was the designer from Artemis that I'd had quite a strong relationship with before and worked really, really well with. So that sort of developed quite quickly.
It seems to me there's a real natural feel element to being a flight controller. You've got to be able to feel it as much as anything.
Yeah, there's lots of little telltale signs, and picturing the boat in its sort of state and what it needs to be at its optimal performance is quite important. But then also just picking the moments to make the thing actually sailable and usable for the team to make the right decisions and to put it in the right places is equally important.
You guys are spending a lot of time on the water, as all the teams are, but you're also able to practice when the boat isn't out there. The simulators are a big thing now in, I think, all elements of high-performance sailing. How does that sit with you? Do you enjoy the simulator, or is it something you kind of you know you have to do?
Yeah, the sims are really good. They're very good for learning, like the HMI, the controllers, getting the muscle memory of the buttons, especially for once you're under pressure, minimizing those mistakes. The simulators, some are a lot better than others in terms of what's real. But once you can sail a boat and then revert back to the sim, you know what's reality and what's not, and then you can sort of use that to make sure that you're practicing the right things instead of just trying to cheat the computer and actually use it for your benefit. So, yeah, for me, they're pretty important, and the resource that it takes to go sailing for a few hours on the sim is so small compared to a few hours, for example, in an America's Cup boat.
We're seeing a lot of the AC teams also taking time out to sail GP as well. It's easy to see that racing around in those catamarans, it's high performance, it's foiling, it's good practice. There's no downside to it, I'm guessing. But how different is it sailing for you, sailing the AC50 or sailing the AC40 as an example?
They're two very different boats for me. The F50, I'm doing the pilot thing. Quite different comms roles on both boats. The 50, I'm not really saying too much. I'm just basically a catch net, pointing out things if Hannah and Ben and Goobs have missed stuff, or the guys at the front. And yeah, you get to run across the boat. You're up quite a lot higher. The boats demand quite different states of height and pitch, whereas the 40 is I'm usually one of the crew at the back, and it's predominantly about the sails, so I stop worrying about the things that are under the water so much, and really going back to the trimming routes and trying to optimize performance there.
Whenever I ask people about sailing these high performance boats and we talk about trimming, they always say, well, it's pretty much the same as sailing any kind of boat. But the bit I can't understand is that you're hurtling upwind at 35 knots, then everything is coming at you really quickly, gusts, lulls, shifts in the breeze. Does it feel like that? Does it feel like everything's happening really fast?
It does initially, and then you become used to the speed and you start thinking further up the course, and I think your reaction timings get quite a lot quicker. It's pretty evident that after a day of high-speed sailing that's really close, how tired everyone would be mentally. You can see everyone's a bit brain-fried and just needs a moment, and it's just because of the intensity that everyone's operated at for, you know, it might even be a half an hour, an hour period of sailing. We've ticked off two or three Sail GP races and you're absolutely cooked because you've just used all your attention for that amount of time. So you do get used to the speed, but that the amount of focus that it takes to operate at the high level is pretty draining.
Now, you guys in the British team, like the Italians, have gone down the LEQ 12 route. It's a less or equal to 12 meters is the where that name comes from. It's a test boat. It's bristling with cameras and data gathering devices, all of which are kind of top secret. But you've been doing that to suck in all that data to kind of help you validate the design tools that you're going to use for the new AC75 that you're going to build. As sailors, how easy is it for you just to keep going out there each day to suck in this data? Do you feel like, is there a feeling of making progress when you're doing all of that?
Yeah, there's a bit of a balance there, but when you have a LEQ12 of trying to tick off the things that the designers want and all the different sections of the team is trying to get the most out of what they can of a package. I guess the sailing team, we're always trying to sail the boat better. We're trying to make certain systems easier to use. We're trying to develop those relationships with the designers on those conversations and on those systems. I guess it's also, yeah, there can be times when it's tricky when you're doing hours of straight lining or a particular sort of test that one party is pretty invested in and needs some information, when another it's not really relevant to a different area. So they're quite they're very balance aren't like there's quite a big balance there that the team's trying to work out, but I feel like that's quite a large part of the America's Cup. But then also ocean racing, when I've done that, it's, you know, hours of straight lining and testing, and even in Olympic sailing you have the same thing. So that's quite strong part of just trying to get the fastest boat.
Do you feel at any time that, oh, I wish we had an AC75, we could be ripping around the bay and or the coast in Barcelona like the Kiwis and you know, like the Swiss are doing?
Yeah, it does look pretty nice ripping around in a big boat at times, but there's definitely trade-offs to each strategic decision. It's very nice having the big lads around and a bit more of a squad and camaraderie in the team, but I guess that's, you know, there's all pros and cons to both sides of it. So they're different strategic options that the leaders of the teams have chosen and the paths that we're on.
Now, the timing of us doing this interview comes just a few days after you had a bit of a wipeout in the LEQ12 while you were towing. I don't want to go down into the details because I know you can't talk to me about it, but how do you react as a team after you've had a serious incident like that? I guess it goes back as well to the capsize in Palma, which was a kind of similar body blow to the team.
Yeah, they're pretty big events that they can shape your campaign a little bit. They can definitely speed you down different paths if you're not careful. They can just shake the rattle the cage a little bit. But I guess with the one that happened the other day in particular, they just happened so quickly, quite unexpected. And every time a big event like that happens, you also learn so much. So it is a little bit of a hit because the boat's off the water for a period of time. But normally when these things have happened, you learn quite a lot from them. You get a chance to change some things that you might not have been able to change. You're trying to look for the positives. And that's kind of just part of equipment failure. It's part of sport.
And I guess in a cup cycle, as long as this one is, every team's going to have something at some point. Everybody's going to have a drama, a calamity.
Yeah, everyone's going to have turns. At the moment, we've just had our one sort of last week. We're lucky we've still got the AC40. We can keep racing. And it is a bit of a hit for the team. But it's nothing that we haven't come back from before, and I'm sure we will.
Sounds like the mood's actually, you've kind of got your heads around it now. The mood's actually quite good now. You're focused on getting things sorted.
Yeah, I guess being in a team that's more than a cycle old, they've experienced harder moments before, and that prepares you to deal with the next ones that are coming. It's good having a strong resource like Mercedes and their support as well. To, you know, they give you good reasons to why things happen like that, and a good plan to move on to.
Looking further ahead beyond the America's Cup, this America's Cup cycle, what goals has Luke Parkinson set himself for sailing? Another edition of the Ocean Race, I think we established that's on the cards. But what about something like a Vendée Globe?
Well, I touched on it at the very start. I do like sailing with other people. I'm definitely open to that, and open to the double-handed stuff. Very much like the offshore and the foiling sort of options, I suppose. Not too sure. I want to keep racing, and I guess that's why Sail GP is so good. There's so many events, and we get to go racing multiple times of the calendar year. So trying to, in a cup cycle, it's quite hard to get enough exposure to racing. And I guess at the end of a cycle, you really want to get a bit of a surge in how much racing you can get in.
You are a high-performance sailor. I know away from the America's Cup, away from Sail GP, you're going to be sailing your moth, or you're going to be wing foiling or kite surfing or something. It's just in your blood, I think.
Yeah, I'm always drawn to those things, and the 18s, I watch them every Sunday on the YouTube. So I'm sure there'll be something.
Luke, we've been talking for over an hour. I said it would be an hour, and I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been fascinating. I'm sure the listeners will enjoy it. So thanks so much.
No worries, thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks go to Luke Parkinson for taking the time to talk to me, and to all of you for listening wherever you are around the world. I'll be back soon with another great sailing interview, and I hope you'll be able to join me then.